The problem of the masses and revolution, the problem I want to talk about today, greatly preoccupied Marx and Marxism. It is, of course, a central problem. What about the proletariat? The proletariat was without class interest, and therefore it was the carrier of the future, but not all the proletariat. Remember that Marx divided the proletariat into three parts. First of all, the unemployed, what he called the reserve industrial army, and with that he was not so greatly concerned. That was not yet such a big problem. Secondly, something that's gone into our language with a word that Marx invented, lumpen proletariat. That is to say, there is no American equivalent, I guess, the proletariat of scoundrels, of Luftmensch, you know what that is, somebody who lives off air. You know, that kind of proletariat who were too lazy to work, yes? Who didn't work, yes? I won't make modern analogies. So, easy to make. So, what you have, therefore, is the lumpen proletariat. That's what Ronald Reagan talks about when he talks about welfare. He thinks they're all a lumpen proletariat in the Marxist sense. And thirdly, typically enough, the active proletariat involved in production. So again, the emphasis that I've stressed all along on production. Marx's theory is a theory of production. So you have again here the production always important in the foreground. Now, Marx and Engels were practical also in this, they thought twice in their life that the time for the proletariat to act was here. Once was the revolutions of 1848, and the other was the so-called Paris Commune of 1870. Both in 1848 and 1870, they thought the time was ripe. And yet there is an inherent contradiction between their immediate excitement about 1848 and 1870 and their, what you might call, worked out theory of revolution. For Marx's worked out theory of a revolution is different. It consists really of two parts. First of all, the paradigm was the French Revolution. That was true for everybody in the 19th century. That is to say, a revolution as a popular uprising with a storming, the taking of the centers of power. You storm, you take the centers of power, like the Bastille. Or to sum it up, the movement of peoples against established authority. The French Revolution as prototype. That is one part of it, and that is true for all 19th century revolutionaries. But there is a second part to it. Marx's own theory that the revolution will only happen when the time is ripe. And the time is only ripe when capitalism has developed to its fullest extent. What that means in practice is a bourgeois revolution must precede the proletarian revolution. The proletarian revolution can only come when everybody has been impoverished and only a few have concentrated the means of production into their hands. This can only come with what Lenin later called monopoly capitalism, when fewer and fewer people own more and more of the means of production. Marx thought that as that happened, more and more people become impoverished, more and more people have less of a stake, if you like, in the existing social order. More and more people will turn and join the proletariat. Because in a sense, then, everybody will be the proletariat, except the very few big bankers and big business who own the means of production. Now, with this kind of theory, you needed the bourgeois revolution first, because unless you had a bourgeois revolution, you couldn't have a concentration of capital accumulation. And a concentration of capital accumulation is vital for Marx's theory. That is clear. Now, what is equally clear is that this theory, revolutionary theory, is a theory for Western Central Europe. It is a theory singularly inapplicable to underdeveloped countries. Singularly inapplicable. And Marx, in fact, didn't believe a revolution would start in underdeveloped countries. He supported the British occupation of India. He supported the British in India because the British might create an Indian middle class who would then start the cycle going. So he was all for the British remaining in India. In other words, Marx was no anti-colonialist, period. That's a great mistake. Marx believed in colonialism until a native middle class, if you like, had been created, which could start the process. First, you had to create a proletariat. You had to industrialize. And then the proletariat, capital accumulation had to take place. And that you still see reflected in the Third World, in the desire to industrialize in the Third World. Because it's quite true, you cannot have a Marxist revolution in Marx's idea, fully worked out idea, without industrialization. Now, so far, so good. But in 1848, he threw it over. Because here was revolution in underdeveloped countries taking place. And so, in the Communist Manifesto, stands apart from putting forward a second theory. And the theory in the Communist Manifesto is as follows, that the German bourgeoisie is too weak, and therefore, in a sense, in Germany now that a revolution is taking place, the bourgeois stage has to be skipped, and the proletariat must immediately seize power. Now, if you read the Communist Manifesto, it starts out very conventional. Our epoch, he says, the epoch of the bourgeoisie possesses this distinguished feature. It has simplified the class antagonism. Society as a whole is more and more splitting into two hostile camps, two great classes, bourgeoisie and proletariat. So far, so good. That is the conventional Marxist theory. Hitherto, every form of society has been based on the antagonism of oppressing and oppressed classes. And then he tells you about the serf. The modern laborer, on the contrary, instead of rising with the progress of industry, sinks deeper and deeper below the conditions of existence. He becomes a pauper, and so does everyone else. In other words, that is still this theory I've told you of pauperization, that as more and less people control the means of production under high capitalism, under the consequences of the bourgeois seizure of power, under high capitalism, Marx believed the rest of the population would ever become more and more pauperized because they would be more and more removed from controlling any of the means of production. At that point, he says, the bourgeoisie is unfit to rule because it is incompetent to assure an existence to its slave, within its slavery, because it cannot help letting him sink into such a state that it has to feed him instead of being fed by him. In other words, that's what Marx means with the famous phrase, the proletariat is the grave digger of the bourgeoisie. Because with capital accumulation, with the concentration of the means of production ever less and less hands, you get a situation where the proletariat is so pauperized that it has to be fed instead, that it's no longer productive, as we say. It's no longer productive. And at that point, typically again a theory of production, at that point society can no longer live under this bourgeoisie, and at that point you have a revolution. Now that's fine. But in 1848, at the end of the Communist Manifesto, he really contradicts all of this as far as Germany is concerned. For Germany, he says, the bourgeoisie is too weak. Yes? They never cease, he says about the German bourgeoisie, for a single instant to instill into the working class the clearest possible recognition of the antagonism between bourgeoisie and proletariat. Therefore, the German workers may straightaway use the social and political condition to fight, and he says, the fight against the bourgeoisie itself may immediately begin. And he was thinking of something historical, that in the revolution of 1848, there was a radical revolution, not a liberal, a radical revolution in the state of Baden, on which Marx pinned, mistakenly, of course, very great hopes. And he thought the radical revolution in the state of Baden was the future. Well, obviously, it was not the future. And why do I mention it? I mention it for a very important reason, because Lenin will go back to the Communist Manifesto, because Lenin has no bourgeoisie in Russia. He cannot make a Marxist revolution under Russian condition. So Lenin and Bolshevism goes back to the Communist Manifesto and not to the revolutionary theory as Marx had worked it out. For that revolutionary theory becomes in Marx, if you like, deepened and accepted through all the things that Friedrich Engels wrote to Marx from Manchester. The capitalism was not collapsing. The English worker was not getting impoverished. Now, Marx was no fool, far from it. And so, in the most advanced industrial country, the country on which Marx pinned its greatest hopes, England, the theory was not coming true. And so Marx eventually revised his theory in a famous inaugural address of the Working Men's International Association of 1864. We know it as the First International, the Working Men's International Association of 1864. And he reminds them that the British working classes had won political victory. They just won the victory of the 10-hour bill, of the 10-hour work week. And therefore, he says, to conquer political power has become the great duty of the working class. Now, this speech of 1864 became, if you like, the Magna Carta of European social democracy. It became the basic charter. It was based on the English tradition. The workers weren't getting impoverished. And so Marx grabbed at political action. Maybe the thing is to do what the Chartists did in England, first English labor movement, if you like, the victory of the 10-hour bill. Maybe the way is to act politically, because economically things weren't coming together, as we would say. Things weren't coming together, according to his theory. And after 1864, Marx concentrated on workers' organization, first organizing the First International, as we call it, Working Men's International Association, then eventually organizing the Second International International Association when the first split up, so that he spent his time now in organization, because he believed that now was of prime importance, as it certainly was, for political action. But here again, there was, after all, a dead alley, because he couldn't organize this little splinter group for any political effectiveness. These kind of people he got together there weren't very effective. And the effective organization was done by his great enemy, LaSalle, in the famous German Working Men's Association of 1863. It was his great enemy, LaSalle, who got out the armies with his statism, with his national ideas, with his political ideas, with his ideas of democracy of 1848, which Marx always, of course, rejected. So that it wasn't working. And so finally comes the Battle of Sedan, the loss by Napoleon III of the Battle of Sedan, the siege of Paris in 1870, the formation of the Paris Commune, in which, for the first time in history, members of the working classes were represented on the ruling junta, as we would say, on the ruling committee. For the first time in history, members of the working classes were represented in the Paris Commune, that is the Paris city government, but it claimed, of course, to be the government of France, the Paris Commune, and that was heady stuff, very heady stuff. And so Marx summarized his ideas in the last and very important work, The Civil War in France. He wrote this in 1871, and that hope had collapsed. The Paris Commune, the proletariat hadn't seized power. They had been beaten, but they had been beaten in a bloody civil war. Remember, that was very bloody. The Tuileries Palace burned down, much of Paris burned down in the civil war, which followed Paris Commune, in which it was suppressed. So that here was a different thing than 1848. In 1848, nothing much had happened. It had been, you know, like we say, you go to the Rubicon to fish and you just sit down. You don't cross it. Yeah? And Marx had that idea very much in 1848, that people just sat down. But in 1870, there had been a war. And so in the Civil War of France, Marx goes back, in fact, to his mature thought and strengthens it. It's developmental. Each crisis in the class struggle brings out more forcefully the desperation of the dying order. And each crisis, therefore, makes for more cruel suppression. You now have a theory not only of pauperization, you have a theory of suppression, very apropos of the Paris Commune and what happened after the Paris Commune was, in fact, defeated. So its leaders were exiled or imprisoned. So what you have, therefore, is the desperation of a dying order, the bourgeois order, and the cruelty of suppression. Repressive state power used by the bourgeoisie confronts the worker ever more directly. Now, what happens when the oppressive state power confronts the worker ever more directly, as it did after 1871 in France? It makes the work of the Communist Party easier. It makes it possible to raise the consciousness of the worker, not the lumpen proletariat, the worker, the productive worker, the consciousness of the productive worker, and guide him towards revolution. It makes him see the consequences of the control of the means of production. It is not just a matter of pauperization. It is a matter of the direct experience of the oppressive state power. Marx more and more sees now the state as one of the enemies. The state, he always did, but more and more, the state a power. This theory is based on the previous revolutions. As Marx puts it, the revolutions of 1830 in France, of 1848 all over Europe, and the Paris Commune are all steps in this process. It's all steps in that process. In every one of these revolutions was followed by greater oppression. In every one of these revolutions, therefore, was followed by greater consciousness, if you like, on greater part of the working classes. Because as we learned last time, Marx was not a materialist. He didn't believe this was all scientifically predestined, as Engels tended to believe. It is really still a matter of a consciousness. And he has to deny, therefore, what he had first asserted, that the revolution of 1848 had any hope. He has to deny that now. He, in effect, repudiates the Communist Manifesto in the Civil War in France, indirectly, but he certainly does. And he has to deny, of course, that the Paris Commune was socialist. They are all steps, don't you see, steps in the severity of oppression on the part of a desperate, on the part of a ever more desperate bourgeoisie. Now you can see there is a contradiction here, there no doubt is. On the one hand, fewer and fewer people are controlling more and more of the means of production. But on the other hand, those fewer and fewer people are becoming ever more and more desperate. That is to say, it's a kind of odd theory that the more power you have, the more desperate you are. Something I think you would be different. I mean, after all, Marx's prophecy came true as far as capitalism is concerned, certainly. Fewer and fewer people have controlled more and more of the means of production. But as I look at our corporate leaders, so-called, I don't see them to be very desperate, unfortunately, but there it is. Thus we must say that though you can say some of it has come true, of course, two things have not come true. First of all, the working classes hasn't risen in consciousness, because Marx underestimated the process of co-optation. Somehow he thought, and I don't quite know why, I don't think anybody did, perhaps because he thought too much in abstractions, in spite of the social ideas and emphasis. He thought too much of abstraction. Why did he think the ruling classes were so stupid? See? Because obviously they are far from stupid. They're extremely intelligent. They co-opt with the greatest success. In fact, they have co-opted everything. So, in fact, the worker becomes a bourgeoisie in attitude and everything else. That is, I think, because Marx omitted something of fundamental difference, which we've talked about in this course, but which he just assumed. He was a man of his time. He did not see the great seduction of, let us say, bourgeois ideas of respectability, a bourgeois lifestyle. He did not really see the seduction of his own lifestyle on the workers. And he didn't see that in his lifetime people could still rise in the social scale. It was not foreclosed. There was always co-optation. People can still rise today. That is to say that there is always enough rising so that many people, in fact, do not feel locked in. He, of course, and this may be because of his economic emphasis, had no theory of psychiatry or psychology. He had no theory, obviously, of perceptions, because otherwise he would have seen, of course, that arising is a very differentiated thing, Some people think they've already risen when they have lace curtains, and they're quite satisfied. So that it's a complete idiocy to think that everybody wants to be president or head of a corporation or something. A great many people are satisfied if they can have the lifestyle of the bourgeoisie, obviously. Now, he didn't see that. He didn't think in terms of lifestyles and anything. He thought in terms of the human essence, on the one hand, as I've stressed, reason, rationality, and happiness. And rationally, you shouldn't be satisfied. And as he said, a slave will always fight for his freedom. He didn't see that you could buy off people, but I don't mean really buy off, because that has connotations I don't mean. When people are satisfied, they're satisfied. In other words, you could co-opt people rather easily. He didn't see that. He couldn't see that. And of course, in his own time, the Industrial Revolution was still progressing. But there's something else he didn't see, or if you like, he could not see very well. And that is, of course, the change in the nature of the revolution. Because if we have talked about Marx's strategy for bringing a revolution about, how did he conceive the revolution of happening? Now, it is clear that we have been so imbued with Leninism. But Leninism doesn't go to Marx on that. It goes to Marx's greatest rival, a man Marx despised, Blanqui, an eternal putschist. He made one putsch after another, Colonel Gaddafi of his day. One putsch, more intelligent, I think. One putsch after another. And he believed that the order could only be overthrown by professional revolutionaries, professional putschists, if you like, professional revolutionaries. And Marx rejected this completely, because his model was the French Revolution. And so there had to be a vanguard of the proletariat. There had to be a communist party. But its communist party was organizing an education. It was not a party preparing to practice a dictatorship after the revolution. That is a Blanquist notion. Blanqui believed you overthrow a government by a coup d'etat. Yes? And then you have to take over. There was no storming of the Bastille. You do it by professionals. Now, Lenin took over Blanquist ideas, and in a way, rightly so. Because in Russia, conditions were different. In Russia, you did have professional revolutionaries under the Tsarist oppression. Marx's theory was made for industrialized countries, not for a Tsarist dictatorship. That is clear. So that in Russia, Lenin fell back on Blanquiism, as a matter of fact, believed in professional revolutionaries, believed that these professional revolutionaries should exercise dictatorship before and after the revolution. And in the Russian condition, of course, you can see why. Nobody thought as yet that the Russian conditions would be exported to industrial Europe as they were after the Second World War. Nobody thought of that. For Marx, things were really different. Because Marx specifically rejects the Jacobins on which Blanqui again is built. Blanqui built it on the Jacobins, the Robespierre, the rule of terror among the Jacobins, that you have to have that in order to firm the revolution. Marx was not a Jacobin. Lenin was a Jacobin. Marx was not a Jacobin in that case. But what took over is a class. Now, a class is something quite different than a professional revolutionary group, a professionary revolutionary coterie. It is something quite different. Because after the revolution, what happens? After the revolution, the masses would be, for Marx, prepared and enlightened. And then we shall see. But no dictatorship, because everybody would be the proletariat, after all, in his theory. And the proletariat would be enlightened enough to have made the revolution. So after the revolution, they would take over, and a dictatorship, like in the French Revolution, would be avoided. That is to say, Marx still believed in the spontaneous uprising of the masses. And afterwards, if you like, in spontaneous control. What you find here really at issue is that if you looked at the original model of the French Revolution, democracy is still a revolutionary demand. That democracy and revolution are still linked in this image of the storming of the Bastille. That they are still linked. That the imminent democratic revolution would determine what happens in the future. Perhaps through the organized labor movement. But Marx foresaw no oppression. Why? That's clear. Because after the revolution, the human essence will work. And here, Marx is not a Jacobin, but a Rousseauist. That is to say, once the revolution is over and the old order is down, then your basic essence, your wish for rationality and happiness, will make everything come out all right. So the society will be a rational society. It will be a happy society. It will be a society of freedom, because your essence is being oppressed by bourgeois society. But bourgeois society is finished, so that every man can rule his own, and you can hunt in the morning and fish in the afternoon, and all this sort of thing can come about. But there was another theory Marx had which helped this kind of democracy to come about. Marx believed, and he tried to show that in economics, that man never tackles a problem unless he can solve it. Now that's a good Enlightenment belief, that all problems are soluble. Because man never poses a problem unless he can solve it, because man is a rational creature. Therefore, no problem is posed unless this problem can also be solved. Now, that means concretely that the classless society, if you like, and we'll talk more about it, that the classless society will have problems, but they will be solved. And they will be solved in tune with rationality and freedom and the desire of happiness. The classless society depends on the human essence, depends again on the essential humanism. Now, this, of course, was not to be continued for two reasons. First of all, Engels' scientism put it in question. And for Engels, the laws of science were more important than the laws of human nature. In fact, science determined everything. Therefore, there was no need to storm the Bastille. Therefore, things could have a logical transition, just as the giraffe's neck in Darwin is stretched because its food is in the trees, so the bourgeois society will inevitably fall. Yes, when capitalism develops, that is social democracy. That's Kautsky and Bernstein and social democracy. But the laws of science made an almost automatic revolutionary strategy which would enable the laboring masses to concentrate on immediate gratification. As the long-term strategy was taken care of, by the laws of science, you could gratify yourself immediately. And that's, of course, the justification for trade union activity. So trade union activity is immediate gratification, and you concentrate on trade union activity, more food, more salary today and not tomorrow, because the laws of science work for the abolition of class society. Well, that's one thing. But as far as Lenin was concerned, it was called something else, the needle gun. The needle gun invented in 1860, yes? The needle gun. And then, of course, by 1880, the invention of the machine gun. You couldn't storm, as I've told you before, any Bastille anymore. Five soldiers with machine guns could have mowed down the crowd that came to storm the Bastille, yes? An army with needle guns can do whatever it wants to a spontaneous mass. So you had to change the revolutionary theory to Blanquism, to a professional revolutionary elite, to the dictatorship of the proletariat. Because you didn't only have to control the masses of production, you also had to control the machine guns and the needle guns, and you had to have discipline to do that. You had to fight one army with another. It wasn't so easy. I mean, after all, who looked after the Bastille? A few half-drunken guys with primitive weapons. It's very easy. Now, of course, here Lenin was right and Marx was wrong, because it is a fact of modern history not realized by very many so-called revolutionaries. That is why we shall never see a revolution in our lifetime in industrial countries, that industrial countries you cannot take by storm. It's all very well in underdeveloped countries, in San Salvador, Nicaragua, or in Africa, to occupy the radio station and the government buildings and the newspaper office. But how the hell are you going to do it in the United States or Germany or France? It doesn't do any good whatsoever. So, obviously, spontaneity is an idiotic road to revolution, as we tried to tell our students in 68, and that's why I never took them seriously. These were children's plays in 68 when these students marched on the Capitol, these student riots. They were children's play. In modern society, you cannot overthrow that society. In fact, no industrial state has ever been overthrown from within. No industrial state has ever been overthrown within, it is probably almost impossible to do. So that Lenin, of course, was right here, at any rate. And since Lenin's time, there has been more concentration of power, economic power, military power, all sorts of power in the hands of, if you like, the ruling classes. But I think the greatest power is the power of co-optation. Most people don't want a revolution. I mean, the best thing said during our student riots was by the then governor, Knowles. The most sensible thing during the entire riots. The students aren't going to overthrow the state of Wisconsin. You're damn right they're not going to. The only thing necessary was to get your car out of the parking place so they wouldn't damage it with their iron bars they carried around. So otherwise it was a foolish bit of coin. Because the other thing is, of course, you must not forget that students can only be in the vanguard. And Marx realized that. He never considered students as anything. Students are only in the vanguard in unindustrialized countries. Why? Because the rest of the population is scattered and unarticulate. So the students, and that is why in Europe the students were important. Until 1870, the students were important. In the revolution of 1848 in Germany and so on, the students played a relative part, and then they play no part at all. Because as articulateness and reading and writing and the means of communication spread, students are expendable. There is no need for the creature at all. But until then, in underdeveloped countries, they are the only articulate. They are the only ones who are together. They are only the ones who have leisure. They have nothing to do. So they can they can, well, that's important for revolutions, very important. You see, that Marx didn't realize either with his work ethic. You have to think things through. You have to conspire. You have to organize. All that takes time, yes? That you have to have a leisure. And as I told you once before, Marx has no theory of leisure at all. It was a great mistake. You can't make a revolution without leisure. Can't do that at all. What you have, therefore, here, I think, is clear. You have the development outrunning Marx, and Marx's revolutionary model becoming singularly antiquated, out of date, out of date. And still more out of date today. Instead, any spontaneity is out of date as far as changing government or anything like that is concerned in industrial nations. I'm not talking about non-industrial nations. Non-industrial world is about the state that Europe was at in the French Revolution. There are probably still Bastilles to be stormed. Industrial, you can't. That is why I think myself that South African apartheid regime will never be overthrown. From inside, it'll never be overthrown. Never. A million years. Because quite impossible to overthrow from the inside, no matter what you do. So highly industrialized, and in this case, so highly successful, industrialized, centralized society where all the power is centralized. One machine gun can do a hell of a lot in the hands of unscrupulous people, you know. One machine gun is the end of revolution, and that's a quote from Lenin, and he was, of course, quite correct. What you have is, in fact, that industrial societies, there's only been one successful revolution at all of that nature, is, of course, the Soviet Revolution. The only other successful revolutions have been fascist revolutions. Why that should be so, nobody likes to face, especially not those who are leftists. But they better think about that, because there's a great lesson in this for revolutionaries themselves, that the only successes in industrialized countries have been fascist revolutions. Socialists have failed and failed and failed in their revolution in this century since the foundation. So you can say Marxist revolutionary model has never been at all important. Now, all I'm saying is that Marx, of course, was a man of one season and not all seasons, and that should not be surprising. On the whole, his idea of revolution is still democratic. Not in the way of La Salle. He didn't want a parliament. He didn't think of universal suffrage. And therefore, he left the classless society singularly vague. Because again, it's the human essence. And in the practical revolutionary necessity which Lenin confronted and then the communist parties in Europe confronted, you couldn't leave it that vague. You had to go back not to Marx, but to Blanqui. To professional revolutionary agitators and professional revolutionaries. As you see by the ruling people in Russia, nobody in Russia in the Politburo has done anything else but be a professional revolutionary. They've never had any other job. But of course, you have another irony. This kind of revolution becomes the true conservatism. The true conservatism today is the Soviet Union. What else? Telling you anything new. And the communist Europe is the true conservative. So you get really the true conservatism in the end. Leninism becomes the true conservatism because, of course, democracy is excluded. It's excluded. It becomes a dictatorship. There was never any idea how you can abolish the dictatorship of the proletariat. And it climaxes in Stalinism, friend of mine rightly called a mixture between Bolshevism and fascism. And that's a very good definition of Stalinism. It is a mixture between Bolshevism, I think, and fascism itself. So what you have, therefore, is the matter. Now, what comes out of that is a very large question that I want to address next time. Does the dialectic then stop? And of course, in a sense, it does stop, because the proletariat no longer, everybody controls the means of production. So there can't be any class struggle anymore. That's clear. Yes? That's clear. So in a sense, the dialectic does stop, of course, in the end. And in a sense, I suppose, in the end, you have a kind of utopia which isn't very much different from the utopias you have throughout history, because it is a utopia of satisfaction and work. If you look at the 17th century utopias, 16th century, they're very much the same. Thomas More's utopia, or whatever have you, they are a mixture of work and satisfaction, and as Marx put it, and I've cited so often, hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon. But Marx never thought that the classless society, and that you must not forget, would be an escape from work. It will also be based on production. For Marx assumed that man was happiest when he is productive. And perhaps that was his last mistake, because there are many people who sleep under date trees or whatever, yes? So it is not necessarily that man is happiest when he is productive. That's only true for people like myself with a Protestant and Prussian upbringing, or a mixture between the two. It can be a pretty deadly mixture. It's probably not true for many of you who would just as soon sleep under a date tree. So what you have, therefore, is Marx was European. He never looked at other civilizations. I mean, you know, he never looked at other civilizations where productivity may not be the standard of happiness and the good, you see. That does exist, such civilizations. But it's difficult for you to grasp, and therefore for Marx. So you get a second sort of thing that may make it out of date, that in a scarcity, in an age of scarcity, it may be much better if more people lie under palm trees than if they become productive. It might be very well true. So again, something that makes Marx a one season. Now, as on Monday you want a discussion, then please think of something to discuss.